your farm, and your future matter to us. Welcome to Dairy Stream, a podcast focusing on opportunities and challenges impacting the future of dairy. This podcast is brought to you by the Dairy Business Association and Edge Dairy Farmer Cooperative, sister organizations fighting for sensible dairy policy in Wisconsin and Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Joanna Guza. Welcome to Dairy Stream with an extra episode with a dairy market update and the potential impact on federal milk marketing orders, or FMMOs. To get you up to speed, the USDA oversees the FMMO program, which includes 11 milk marketing orders and applies to about 75% of total U.S. milk production. Federal orders serves to maintain stable marketing relationships for all handlers and producers supplying marketing areas and facilitating the complex process of marketing fresh milk. The federal milk marketing order pricing formula hearings were held from August 2023 to January of 2024. Dairy groups had the opportunity to submit proposals, transcript corrections, and now recently submitted brief documents on April 1st. The process allows the federal order provisions to meet the changing needs of the dairy industry. Edge represents over 800 dairy farmers, and last year, Edge members produced 16 billion pounds of milk, which makes Edge the third largest cooperative in the country. All proposals that Edge presented contribute to improve price discovery of all classes of milk, eliminating negative PPDs, and maintain or improve risk management opportunities. Our guests today are Mike North. He spent nearly 30 years working with both producers and processors, or the end users of agricultural commodities, to address and manage their exposure to commodity risk. Mike is currently the president of the producer division at EverAg. We also have Maren Bozic. Maren has nearly 20 years of experience in the dairy industry, and he testified at the federal milk marketing order hearing and serves as the dairy economist on the Edge Board of Directors. We also have Tim Trotter, CEO of Edge Dairy Farmer Cooperative. Tim, can you set the foundation of why we're having this extra podcast to share with Edge members and our listeners?
Thank you, Joanna. You know, Edge always wants to lean into the conversations. I don't care what farm I go on to these days. They're asking about where's the market going? Can it go any lower? What do we expect for the future of the dairy commodities? It's on everybody's mind. Anybody who's trying to balance their checkbooks and look at their balance sheets, they're all concerned about this. But also, as we've talked about, you know, dairy markets, and we see all these proposals that have been coming into the federal orders through the hearing process, how will those federal orders really impact different federal orders, like in Federal Order 30, for an example? So I think it was a good opportunity for us to take the expertise of Mike North and Dr. Bozic and really kind of look into this and really take a deep dive into some of the impacts that this could have on our dairy farmers. Because ultimately, we want you all to be informed, and we want to be able to bring you this programming to help add value to your farm. So with that, Joanna, this is where we're going.
Right. And let's start with that value. We're going to talk with Mike North first. Mike, can you provide an overview of what you've seen in the markets?
Yeah, absolutely. Of late, there's really been two major discussions that are of interest in the upper Midwest. One is what is going on with the quote unquote bird flu as it impacts cows around the country. And certainly we're even evaluating what name we should give this, but cows being sick, losing milk production, finding virus pathogens and fragments in different forms on the farm, off the farm, how is this going to impact milk supply? And I think, you know, as we watch markets very closely, also, what type of a consumer response are we to expect from this? And certainly we've seen the market interact with both of those possibilities. There's still, I think, as many or more questions as there are answers around this, but I think we watch with a very eager eye around what exactly the market will do with this information. And I think for any dairyman that is following this story, I think it's important to treat it as a story that could really take the market in either direction, and that you have to be ready to accept both outcomes. If the market really starts to focus on lost milk supply and a slowdown in milk output that adds on top of an already slow milk output in the first quarter of 2024 on top of two successive quarters in 2023 of declining production. If that's where we focus our energy, that could be a very price positive story. However, I think the bigger concern is that this becomes a quote-unquote health concern among our consumer, and that we lose consumer interest in our products. And that is still very much an unknown at this point. So far, we've been able to hang our hat on pasteurization and how we can manage this virus before it reaches food supply. But emotions are an interesting and funky thing in the marketplace. Regardless of the science, regardless of the logic, you just don't ever know exactly how people emotionally will respond to this news. So we're watching it very, very closely. And of course, you know, as you dovetail that into other fundamentals, we do have, you know, a shorter cow supply. We've been in the milk production report that came out Monday. We've shown now 10 months of successive cow number reductions year over year. We watch as replacement heifers have been tight. That certainly is a story that every producer wants to tell, but I think the bigger concern has been around demand. And as you look at Chinese imports, they continue to lag. If you look at GDT performance, it has been a very soft outcome since the beginning of February, with almost every successive global dairy auction showing lower results, with the exception of the auction that took place two events ago. We're watching as, you know, we continue to see what I'll call sluggish demand domestically. And, you know, as we look at the cheese price specifically and talk about that particular market, which in the upper Midwest here certainly carries a lot of weight, it's been rallying of late as we've watched different traders taking advantage of the opportunity for carry in our marketplace. We anecdotally get, you know, very mixed reviews around food service versus retail demand. You know, that demand has really overshadowed the supply story for a very long time. And as it has, the shortened supply has just not been able to gain the stage it needs to tell the story of why milk should be higher. And so as we walk this thing forward, any little undulation in price is noteworthy. And I would say in the last 2 weeks, we've had a very special move in cheese prices, taking spot values to $1.76 on the block and $1.77 on the barrel before a 2 cent retreat on Wednesday. And that has spelled out into a nearby price rally that has taken values back north of $18 all the way forward through the end of the year. As we look at average prices out into the Q3 and Q4 timeframes, at their peak, we saw values that were just short of $19 on Class 3. Class 4 is a whole different animal. It has been leading the charge in terms of value. All sorts of numbers out there that are north of $20, even $21 as you go further out into the year. Really, really high valuations there with some of the disparity between Class 3 and Class 4. As it is, presenting some really solid opportunities for dairymen. And so we've just encouraged that in this market that's really torn in both directions, we need to be addressing price and we need to be going after some of these, you know, opportunities. For example, Class 3 today, you know, you can buy Q3 coverage. Well, yesterday, I should say, you could buy Q3 coverage at $17.77 and Q4 at $17.54, which when you lay that over Class 3 price history, that puts us in one of the top five or six different outcome potentials over the course of the last 20 plus years. Q4, kind of the same camp. Not quite as top five, if you will, but certainly in our top 10 over the last 24 years, going back to the beginning of this new millennia. That said, we really encourage producers to be, you know, very forward-looking in how they manage risk around all of these different issues, whether it be the advent of bird flu or some sort of newfound interest in product. However this thing spins, we're in a very interesting time.
Yeah, very interesting indeed. And we'll jump more into some of those specifics and talking about those different classes with the FMMO reform. But before we do that, Mike, you know, there's a lot of new processing plants that are being built, and we have a map that Marin had put together. I'll make sure that I link that in this podcast for you to see this map. But how will this impact markets in the future years?
As we look at milk production, if you were to lay a milk production map out there and look at what's been happening, areas that ultimately service more powder and butter have been very light on milk production, while the upper Midwest and areas that are a little bit heavier in class three have continued to show, you know, relatively neutral or positive milk production growth. And so as we've built out this new infrastructure and new capacity, and when you look at the numbers, there's about 26 new plants that are ultimately in some phase of construction. Eight of those are cheese oriented. So as you look at that, and most of them being somewhere in the upper Midwest or in that I-29 corridor down into the Panhandle, Texas, we're going to continue to see production moving in to those spaces to support that new capacity. And, you know, I think part of why we've seen the Class 4 response is kind of the flip side of that. The milk production just, you know, hasn't been there. It hasn't gone through those plants. We haven't made the product to create the kind of inventories that we have in the Class 3 marketplace. So, you know, we're going to see some shifting. And keep in mind that this goes through cycles. If you go back to 2020, the food box program kicked in. We created major incentives for cheese producers. And ultimately, that sent messages back through the economy to say we need more cheese capacity. Well, that never happens overnight. We're starting to see some of the tail of that as these new plants come online. With Class 4 where it's at, I would expect we're going to start to see an echo of this movement in the areas to, you know, promote growth in that capacity. So there's always an ebb and flow, Joanna, but, you know, as you look at the place we stand today, the focus is around that cheese production, and that's part of why you see milk production responding in kind.
And before we jump to get Marin's take on this, this is either for Tim or Mike. I mean, I'm always optimistic about new development, new plants, new research, but is the supply chain keeping up? All those little pieces, we build this new plant, is the infrastructure there to keep pushing that product and get that out so farmers see that on their milk check?
The answer is ultimately yes, but here's the problem with demand. It's never a smooth line. The categories, as they grow, don't grow in this very perfectly linear fashion. They ebb and flow. And we have built a market that's incredibly dependent on exports. And, you know, in some categories, we've been strong. But if you look at overall export performance, it's been lackluster at best, poor in some cases. And as a byproduct of that, any of that product that works its way back into the domestic marketplace has to find a new home, and that creates pressure in all of the other categories and classes. So any slowdown in one causes slowdowns in the other, and that's that herky-jerky nature that we get in demand that, you know, causes that nonlinear performance. But ultimately, long-term, yes, I believe dairy has an incredible story to tell. People enjoy the product. They continue to consume more. Yes, I do believe that, you know, that whole pathway through the supply chain is growing to accept this added production, but they never move in lockstep. They never move perfectly together, you know, between milk production and product consumption. But yes, we're on the right track. We're growing, and, you know, the world market is growing with us.
Tim, did you have a comment?
The only other thing I would say is cost of money and interest rates and inflation has also been kind of a contributor to maybe some slow movement in production too on facilities. I know there's a lot of cheesemakers that would like to do upgrades, and it all comes back to money, right? So I think there's a lot of factors. And like I say, we do respond really well, but I think the processors feel the same things farmers do when it comes on the cost side.
Now, Marin, with the new plants being built, could federal milk marketing order rules impact the geography or product selection of future dairy plants?
Federal order reform, if it's done well, should not affect geography or of plants or product manufacturing. Federal order in general as a policy framework can distort what products are made and where they're made only if it tries to tip the scales too heavily. And you can do that in two different ways. First, through excessive increases in class one differentials. What that basically means is that farmers in fluid heavy areas get a big bump in their milk check, which encourages them to make more milk than is needed for local fluid consumption. And that surplus then has to be put into, you know, through some plants. And that would lead to then either powder or a cheese plant being built in areas where they really should not be built. There are very ambitious requests from dairy groups, producer groups, to increase the class one differentials in this hearing. That would not help producers in the upper Midwest much, not nearly as much as some other regions. It remains to be seen how AMS will rule on that. Certainly, from my standpoint, I have not seen any retail shops lacking milk anywhere around the country, which is something that you would expect to see if the class one differentials are vastly out of whack and the incentives are just not there to bring the milk to the consumer. The other way that federal orders can induce the creation of plants when where plants should not be built is if make allowances are set too high. And then the most efficient plant can essentially produce for the order rather than the market. If I build a commodity cheese plant and if I can pool my milk on a federal order and earn the make allowance that is in excess of what my true operating costs and necessary return to capital are, then maybe I will be incentivized to build or expand that plant even if I don't have a dedicated customer who will buy those products, thinking that I can, you know, just move the market by bringing that product to the spot market and I will still have solid profit margin due to make allowances. Edge has filed a brief cautioning AMS about being too aggressive on make allowances. And in our opinion, make allowances should be set based on the modern, efficient plants, not every single plant out there that maybe hasn't been invested in because its owners had other, perhaps social peace, social justice, subsidized hauling, or other noble motivations that ultimately prevented them from investing. And now they have higher operating costs and, you know, we wouldn't feel it's appropriate for that to percolate to make allowances for everyone. But ultimately, if it's done well, if USDA will be moderate on make allowances and will really think through what are the class one differentials needed to encourage proper movement of milk without creating surpluses, then federal order should not affect where plants are being built. And as Mike pointed out very well, the cheese plants seem to be built over the last few years and currently in progress, despite make allowances that are outdated, despite federal orders that need to be modernized. Why? Because they are being built where the price of milk is set by the free market, not by the regulator, and that where the milk is abundant and where the logistics allow them to minimize the cost of bringing that product to the customer.
Maren, let's talk about Federal Order 30. How might Federal Order 30 be impacted through the federal order changes?
There are changes that will be specific to us, and then there will be changes that are general nationwide. Here in our territory, particularly in Wisconsin, we have a lot of private processors who do not have the benefit of what cooperatively owned organizations can do, which is to reblend. In other words, they can either pay the regulated minimums and be pooled or completely opt out of participating in the pool. That I'm talking about cheese plants, butter plants, the fluid plants always have to be pooled. With the adjustment of make allowances, it will be easier for some of them to, again, become part of the order, be pooled. So in that sense, the amount of milk pooled could increase. But the other impact on Federal Order 30, unfortunately, may be that we don't even know whether there will be Federal Order 30. Federal orders have to be reauthorized every time that there's a major vote like this. And we should not take it for granted that everybody who has the vote will indeed vote to reauthorize Order 30. It's, you know, it would be too conspiratorial to go into further detail and speculate each individual actor's motivations. But orders set a benchmark of what a fair and expected price is. And if you cannot meet that benchmark, perhaps you would like that benchmark to go away as well. So from that perspective, we hope that the Federal Order stays. It's certainly a safety net for our dairy farmers, not in terms of providing a sufficiently high milk price, but providing for orderly terms of trade, which means third-party verification of component tests, which means timely payments every 2 weeks, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot to like about federal orders beyond just the sharing in the benefits of fluid milk sales.
And how might changes in the Class 1 pricing impact dairy margin coverage program? And this question's for Marin.
That's where it gets really interesting. There are most dairy producer organizations are advocating the return to the higher off pricing for Class 1 milk. We currently have the average off pricing plus 74 cents. And we haven't heard, other than Edge, you know, really anyone saying, well, maybe we need to think this through carefully. And here's my argument on that. U.S. consumer fluid milk is much more exposed to class 3 shocks, to cheese shocks, than to powder shocks. Like, in other words, if a U.S. consumer is hurting, they are probably going less to the restaurants, which means that the class 3 price will also be lower. So if the class 1 price, if the beverage milk price is related to class 3, then it is more sensitive to the needs of U.S. consumers. If we divorce the price of fluid milk from the domestic market and tie it more to international market, which is typically where class 4 tends to dominate over class 3, that means that the international market is strong, we could be going after the U.S. customer, the families that are buying milk for their kids, precisely when they can least afford it. So we should be sensitive on how we do this from the consumer perspective. But also, it is false to say that higher class 1 milk price through higher off necessarily benefits all dairy producers. If we increase the price of class 1, we will increase the price of milk around the country. And even if our farmers here in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and the upper Midwest, if they're hurting because the price of cheese is low, they may get lower DMC payments because the price of milk has been artificially inflated in other parts of the country. In other words, to put simply, they can maybe get a few cents higher milk check because the class 1 price went up, but then 20 cents lower payments on DMC because the national all milk price has gone up, because it reflects what happened in other regions of the country more than Wisconsin, more than the upper Midwest. And in the final analysis, the policy change that was designed to benefit all dairy producers, my numbers show over the last few years would have actually hurt producers in upper Midwest if we had it already implemented since 2020. We should be very careful in knee-jerk movements in dairy policy, because there could be unintended consequences that that do not benefit the upper Midwest dairy producers.
Marin, one thing I didn't hear you say, and it was one of our most popular podcasts, was talking about negative PPDs. Really ticked off a lot of people. Can you talk about negative PPDs and how it fits in this conversation with FMMO reform?
Two major dairy producer organizations that have made the strongest push to address that issue are EDGE and American Farm Bureau Federation. And our two organizations have asked for removal, for abandonment of what's called advanced pricing. Advanced pricing means that the price of fluid milk is set before the price of cheese and butter and dry whey for the month. And because of the discrepancy in timing, if the price of manufactured dairy products moves a lot after the price of fluid is set, you can have those negative PPDs and money flowing to the class one manufacturers rather than flowing from them to everybody else in the market. It was perhaps not so much surprising as disappointing that we could not get a consensus, even among dairy producers represented at the hearing, that advanced prices should be abolished. I commend Farm Bureau for leading on this issue, and we are certainly standing hand in hand with them on our request to remove advanced pricing. If we remove advanced pricing, we'll make an important step toward removing one of the major causes of negative producer price differentials.
And Marin, what are some of the next steps? I mean, the hearing process is done. What's next steps for federal milk ordering reform?
The first big news will come out in July of 2024, when USDA will issue their preliminary decision, basically their chance to say, hey, dairy industry, we heard everything that you've testified about and wrote in your brief, and here's what we think is the solution that makes the most sense. They will publish that in writing. It will be public for everybody to see. And then the dairy industry will comment on it and say, hey, you, USDA, you got this wrong, or you got this right, and you know, we support you doing that. And everybody will take their own perspective to take a hit at USDA or to try to encourage them to stay the course with what, you know, elements they propose that they like. Then sometimes later this year, USDA will respond to receive comments and will issue a final decision, and they will start a road tour of sorts, like going around the country, presenting at the producer meetings, why they have made the decision that they have made. Like, how does that benefit US consumer, dairy farmer, dairy processor, exports, domestic markets, et cetera, et cetera. Then sometimes in first quarter of next year, we will have a series of referendums. Every order will have to vote to either approve or disapprove of the proposed decision. And here's the part that is not often well understood. USDA will set the rules in such a way that it's, you know, gun to your head, do you like this? If you like it, vote yes. If you know, well, we play the Russian roulette. Because if the dairy producers or the entities that will be block voting vote against the USDA decision, then that particular order that voted against the decision gets disbanded. It's not status quo. We cannot have two different set of rules, but that order goes away. It's not inconceivable, unfortunately, that some orders, and I would say that order 30 is at the top of that list by far, is the most likely, could see a vote that maybe is even negative regarding this reform. I think that the jury is still out on that, but certainly some elements that we've heard suggest that we should not take it for granted that the reform will be rubber stamped no matter what AMS decides to do.
And we probably won't see this until 2025.
That's correct. So the referendum will take place sometimes in the first quarter or maybe April 2025. And I anticipate that the changes will be implemented either June 1 or July 1, 2025.
Now, this next question's for Mike. I mean, this is the what-if world, which maybe we shouldn't live in it, but, you know, what if or when these provisions are implemented, how could the dairy industry see the changes? How will it show up in a milk check? And what could be the risk management of the future?
Across the country, we still largely revolve around a Class 3 and a Class 4 framework. And even as you look at parts of the country that are currently deregulated, I think of Idaho, it comes to top of mind, we still price milk in that region largely around a Class 3 market. And so, you know, as we, you know, shift and reshape, in the absence of an order, the market will always figure it out. It will always figure it out. And let's be fair, milk can move a long ways these days. So if we get it wrong in this space, if it does get voted out, with all of this new infrastructure that is in place, it's going to have to very quickly figure out how to keep the plants full. And so the market, I am a firm believer, always gets it right. I mean, it goes through ups and downs, and we have, you know, tug of wars here and there, but the market will work through that. But, you know, as we look, you know, at this Class 1 space, the thing that we'll see right out of the box, if we end up with this, you know, new higher of piece, if that's what comes through some of these hearings and processes, you know, that Class 1 processor isn't going to necessarily be as able to hedge risk the way they can today, because average is simple. I can manage my risk against Class 3 and Class 4, and I'm set. If it's higher of, I've got to literally wait right to the end to see which one's going to be the most important. By then, it's too late. So we take away the ability of the Class 1 processor to hedge as cleanly as they can today, which, you know, that starts to beg questions about what kind of new development will we see in that space? Will people, you know, press forward to come up with new products there when they don't even know how to manage the risk they already have? It becomes a question. You know, and then of course, how does that play back into the milk check? That remains an unknown. But again, a lot of that is still built around class three and class four. So as a producer, I can manage that risk against the class three and class four marketplace. And in the upper Midwest, that's mostly a class three conversation, not entirely, but mostly. And, you know, that being the case, we'll continue to walk forward with whatever we have to work with on the other side of a vote. There's lots of different tools available that don't require you to be a part of a federal order. You know, these insurance products don't require that you're in an order. The exchange does not require that you're in a federal order. The co-ops, the processors, do not require participation in a forward contracting program because they're in a federal order. Yes, there are some different rules that they have to abide by if they are or they aren't, but reality is there's going to be this whole toolbox still available to producers regardless of what the outcome is.
This next question's for Marin and Mike. And Marin, I'll have you take it first. What do farmers need to pay attention to in the next 12 months?
I think that Mike touched upon it in quite in depth. Dairy farmers always need to pay attention to what they can control first and foremost. They may not be able to control what the market price is. They can control whether they have coverage against the drop in market price. What particularly concerns me today is that there seems to be very low utilization of insurance products for the first quarter of 2025 relative to what we would anticipate to be at this point in time. We are already in late April. And to the extent that some farmers may be concerned about using the contracts in the first and the second quarter of 2025 because of the federal order reform, I would like to reassure them that we have done everything in our power to insulate any potential indemnities they receive from any hiccups that may come about as a consequence of this hearing. I can't quite say the same for the third quarter of 2025 as with the same certainty as the second and first and the second quarter of 2025. What farmers should be doing right now is getting comfortable with layering coverage for the first and second quarter of 2025. And we don't see nearly enough of that. As Mike said, there are 24 plants coming online, 8 major cheese plants, and we will see some of that new cheese start hitting the market in the first half of 2025. And to not have coverage for that now, not start layering coverage, would seem to me just like downright gambling, if not irresponsible. That's probably the thing that they can control, that the farmers can control the most, and that they should be paying more attention to.
And Mike, your perspective?
I'll build off of that a little bit. Everything Maren said is 100%. In fact, I'd even go so far as to say as we look around at all the national statistics, I don't even think there's enough coverage on for Q3 and Q4 of this year. But if I'm in the upper Midwest and I'm hearing about all this new capacity that's coming online, the producer in me says, great, there's a home for my milk. I'll have all these wonderful places to send my milk. However, just because milk goes into a cheese plant doesn't mean there's a consumer standing in line just as quickly to grab that next block of cheese that comes out the back door. And so while we'll have a place to send milk and while we'll, you know, still have this new capacity to demand flow, that does not equate to demand. And if we don't have the growth in demand that rises as quickly as the new growth in supply, we will be left with price depression because the inventory that hangs over the market over the months that follow. And so as much as there's some good news to talk about, there are fundamentally some pieces that will be a real hangover for this class three marketplace going forward. And so anyone in the upper Midwest, you know, beyond the orders, beyond the elections, beyond any of the noise that'll grab headlines, needs to be looking at the foundational and fundamental elements that price our market every day.
And before we jump into our last question with Tim, I have a follow-up for either Marin or Mike. And it's kind of addressed probably to Mike because you brought the comment about the noise. What could the election do? What could the farm bill do? I mean, hindsight's 2020, but what could happen with those items happening this year?
Well, you know, we keep hearing that there will be a farm bill even within the next 4 to 6 weeks. I'm still holding my breath on that. I mean, lots of claims, but I'm not going to wait for them to release one in that period of time. If we get one, great, but I'm not wasting a lot of time worrying about whether it comes out or not. The elections are imminent, and certainly there'll be a lot of noise around there, different things coming out that, you know, try to turn heads. But I think, you know, what we have to realize is that we go through this every 4 years, and we still have to milk cows, and we still have to pay feed bills, and we still are looking at our bottom lines. And so regardless of the noise and all of the hope and despair that people try to spin into the election, you got to just pay attention to the marketplace. You know, get away from the noise and look at what's real. And what I always tell people is price is real, because that's real buyers and real sellers coming together to say, this is what we expect to happen. And they can certainly all get it wrong. Things do change, but you got to look at price, because that's what's real, and focus your attention there. Don't get wrapped up in all the noise.
It kind of goes back to Marin's control the controllables. Now, last question as we wrap up this episode of Dairy Stream. Tim, how is EDGE positioning policy to offer dairy farmers protection outside of the FMMO reform?
Good question, Joanna. I think we all along, and this is going back to a task force we established actually during COVID, we thought to ourselves, if we were to recreate this, what would it look? What would the FMMO look like? And we've made tremendous progress building consensus within our organization. And a lot of it came around contracting principles, making sure that relationship with the processor and the farmer was strategic and not just transactional. There's a lot of things within the federal orders that gives us some safeguards. And one of those terms would be getting paid twice a month. We have that luxury with federal orders that farmers will be paid twice a month, and also that they have the verification services for their testing of their milk. Very important third-party work to make sure that the farmer's being treated fairly by the cheese plant, and making sure the equipment's calibrated correctly to make sure that they're getting the rewards they want for the components in their milk. If we don't have a federal order, we don't have those safeguards. Day one, we don't have those safeguards. And as we see the amount of milk in federal order being depooled, and that's climbing up probably every month, and the likelihood that there may be some tense moments coming up in a hearing, depending on what's actually recommended, EDGE has played out the scenario. We're going to make sure, and we're going forward, we're trying to get legislation introduced to provide those two safeguards to farmers immediately, because our farmers cannot tolerate any expectations that they'll be paid less than two times a month. I mean, cost of money, interest rates, inflation, everything is really hurting farms, and we want to make sure those farms have timely payments. That's a must. And I would want to say that, you know, our members shipped over 32 private processors throughout the upper Midwest, and I've never heard any of them say that they wouldn't honor the twice a month. But we just can't go forward with that belief just on a handshake. We believe it needs to be codified in legislation to give farmers those protections. And again, the verification and, you know, just making sure that your components are tested is very, very important to farms, as they know when they look at their milk check, the components is a big area for them on price discovery. So EDGE is working diligently to get a bill introduced to help us in this area. We hope not to use it, but we believe that there needs to be some enabling legislation that just allows for those protections for farms. But again, we've gone into this wanting to make the orders more relevant, and we're not giving up on that at all. We're still working with other dairy organizations, talking about, you know, what scenarios might come out of AMS and how do we handle that. It's not over. I don't want anybody ever to think that it is, but we're paid to think about this because our farmers demand that we keep an eye on this factor. So I would encourage all members to stay tuned, stay involved. But I want to underscore what Mike and Marin have said about risk management. I mean, this is the thing that they can control is risk. They can use there's so many tools they have today that they didn't have 30 years ago. I think there's opportunities here. But again, I think leaning forward and leaning towards your congressman and talking to them about some of these issues, I think are important. You can't believe what kind of impact farmers have. Whenever we go to DC, you know, when we walk in the room, they'll say, who are the farmers? I want to talk to the farmers. So, I mean, this summer, many of them are going to be out in their districts. I would encourage all of them to please reach out to your congressmen and lawmakers and let them know how important dairy is and how they need to have our backs when it comes to legislation. So we are very positive. Again, I mean, we hope that we see some positive outcomes here, but we will always plan for things that may be of risk to our members.
A lot of content to digest, but glad to have experts like Mike North, president of the producer division at EverEgg, Maren Bozick, dairy economist on the Edge Dairy Farmer Cooperative Board of Directors, and Tim Trotter, CEO of Edge Dairy Farmer Cooperative. And just like Tim said, please remember the staff at DBA and Edge are only a phone call or email away and here to answer your questions or your concerns about the future of dairy. If you're interested in getting more involved, you can email me at podcast@dairyforward.com and I will get you connected to the Edge and DBA team. Until next time, I'm Joanna Guza for Dairy Stream. The Dairy Business Association and Edge Dairy Farmer Cooperative would like to thank you for listening to Dairy Stream. If you enjoyed our podcast, please subscribe and rate Dairy Stream. We value your feedback, and if there's something you'd like to hear, email us at podcast@dairyforward.com.